Even in the boozy, druggy days, Johnny Maranville's recall had been pretty relentless. He supposed that was part of being a writer, but he didn't know if it was nature or nurture, cause or effect. The thing was, he remembered shit even when it was as confusing as the final 30 seconds of a big fireworks display. Stuff that overlapped seemed to automatically separate and fall into line even as it was happening, like iron filings lining up under the pull of a magnet. Johnny had never wished for anything different until now. Right now, a little ink squirted into the old memory cells might be just fine. He saw Steve, down on one knee, but apparently okay, bat away the revolver when the woman hucked it at him. She lifted her upper lip, snarled at Steve like a cornered dog, then turned back and clamped her hands around the kid's throat again. "Go on," Johnny shouted at himself. "Go on and help him, like you did before when you shot the cat." But he couldn't. He could see everything, but he couldn't move. At the same moment, Johnny was slammed past the skinny girl and into the room with the force of a stuntman shot from a cannon. It was Ralph, of course, hitting him from behind and bawling his son's name at the top of his lungs. Johnny flew out over the two-step drop, knees bent, and all the time his eyes went on recording and his brain kept on receiving images and storing them. He saw the way Audrey's muscular legs were spread, the material of her skirt strained taut between them. He also saw he was going to touch down near her. He landed on one foot, his knee buckled. He let it, throwing himself forward into the woman, grabbing her hair. She pulled her head back and snapped at his fingers. At the same instant, except Johnny's mind insisted it was at the next instant, even now wanting to reduce this madness to something coherent, a narrative which would flow and train, Steve tore her hands away from the kid's throat. Johnny saw the white marks of her palms and fingers there, filling in with red, and then his momentum was carrying him by. She missed biting him, which was the good news, but he missed his grip on her hair, which was the bad. She voiced a guttural cry as he collided with the wall. At the same moment, Ralph Carver yelled, "Get your hands off my boy, you bitch!" Johnny saw Steve and Ralph drag the screaming woman off David. He saw the boy collapse against the wall and slide slowly down it, the marks on his throat now standing out like sunburned fingers. "Grab the kid, boss!" Steve panted. He was struggling with Audrey, one hand still clamped on her wrists and the other now around her waist. "Grab him and get him out of—" Audrey screamed and pulled free. She retreated a step, saw David, and snarled again, her lips drawing away from her teeth. She made a move to go in his direction, and Ralph said, "Touch him again and I'll kill you. Promise." "Ah, fuck this," Johnny thought, and snatched the boy up. Johnny's back, already outraged by nearly a continent's worth of motorcycling, gave a warning twinge. Audrey tensed to leap at Johnny. Before she could, Steve was on her once more. He grabbed her around the waist again, then pivoted on his heels, the two of them face to face. She was uttering a long and continuous caterwauling that made Johnny's feelings ache. Halfway through his second spin, Steve let her go. Audrey flew backward like a stone cast out of a sling, her feet stuttering on the floor, still caterwauling. "Tuck Allah!" The woman spoke in a voice that was both frightening and powerful, nothing like her earlier one, her storytelling voice. That one had been low and often hesitant. "Boss, you gotta get the kid out, now!" Johnny took a step backward, meaning to do just that. Audrey reached into the pocket of her dress as he did, and brought it out, curled around a fistful of something. She stared at him. Only at him now. John Edward Maranville, distinguished novelist and extraordinary thinker, with her snarling beast's eyes. When she opened her hand and showed him her offering, the emotional weather inside his head changed at once, and yet he still saw everything and sequenced it. He was suddenly consumed with hate for the boy in his arms and overwhelmed by a desire to put something, his motorcycle key would do nicely, into the interfering little prey boy's throat and open him like a can of beer. He thought at first that there were three odd-looking charms lying on her open palm, but they were too big, too heavy. Not charms, but carvings. Stone carvings, each about 2 inches long. One was a snake. The second was a buzzard with one wing chipped off. Mad, bulging eyes stared out at him from beneath its bald dome. The third was a rat on its hind legs. "Kanta!" she screamed. "Kanta! Kantak! Kill the boy! Kill him now! Kill him!" Steve stepped forward. He slapped the stones from her hand, and they flew into the corner of the room. Audrey screamed with horror and frustration. The murderous fury which had come over Johnny's mind dissipated, but didn't depart completely. He could feel his eyes wanting to turn toward the corner where the carvings lay, waiting for him. All he had to do was pick them up. "Get him the fuck out of here!" Steve yelled. Audrey lunged for the carvings. Steve seized her arm and yanked her back. Her skin was darkening and sagging. Johnny thought that the process which had changed her was now trying to reverse itself. She was, what, shrinking? Diminishing? He didn't know the right word, but... "Get him out!" Steve yelled again, and smacked Johnny on the shoulder. That woke him up. He began to turn, and then Ralph was there. He had snatched David from Johnny's arms almost before Johnny knew it was happening. Ralph bounded up the stairs, clumsy but powerful, and was gone from the projection room without a single look back. Audrey saw him go. She howled and lunged for the stones again. Steve yanked her back. There was a peculiar ripping sound as Audrey's right arm pulled off at the shoulder. Steve was left holding it in his hand like the drumstick of an overcooked chicken. One-armed, the right side of her dress now darkening with blood, she made for the carvings, gibbering in that strange language. Steve was frozen in place, looking at what he held, a lightly freckled human arm with a Casio watch on the wrist. Before Audrey could fall on her knees in the corner and grab her toys, Cynthia kicked them deftly away, sending them skittering along the wall with the cutouts in it. Audrey howled again, and this time a spray of blood came out of her mouth along with the sound. She turned her head to them, and Steve staggered backward, actually raising a hand as if to block the sight of her from his vision. Audrey's formerly pretty face now drooped from the front of her skull in sweating wrinkles. Her staring eyeballs hung from widening sockets. Yet none of this was the worst. The worst came as Steve dropped the hideously warm thing he was holding, her arm, and she lurched to her feet.
"I'm very sorry," she said,
and in her choked and failing voice, Steve heard a real woman, not this decaying monstrosity.
"I never meant to hurt anyone. Don't touch the cantas. Whatever else you do, don't touch the cantas."
Steve looked at Cynthia. She stared back, and he could read her mind in her wide eyes.
"I touched one. Twice. How lucky was I?"
"Very," Steve thought. "I think you were very lucky." Audrey staggered toward them and away from the pitted gray stones. She made it about halfway down the short but steep flight of stairs leading to the second floor hall, then fell. The sound of her inside her blood-soaked dress was grisly, a splashing sound almost. She began to crawl, her hair hanging in strings, mercifully obscuring most of her dangling face. At the far end, by the stairs leading down to the lobby, Ralph stood with David in his arms, staring at the oncoming creature. But the thing which had been Audrey Wyler had no further interest in David, it seemed. It reached the arched entrance to the balcony, then crawled through it. Almost at once the support timbers, dried out by the desert climate and dined upon by generations of termites, began to groan. Steve hurried after Johnny, his arm around Cynthia. Ralph came toward them from the other end of the hall. They met just in time to see the thing in the soaked dress reach the balcony railing. Audrey had crawled over the mostly deflated sex doll, leaving a broad streak of blood and less identifiable fluids across its plastic midsection. What remained of Audrey Wyler was still clutching the railing, still attempting to pull itself up enough to dive over the side, when the supports let go and the balcony tore away from the wall with a large, dusty roar. Audrey tumbled over the side. For just a moment, Steve saw her feet sticking out of the dust, and then she was gone. A moment later, and the balcony was gone too, falling like a stone and hitting the seats below with a tremendous crash. Dust boiled up in a miniature mushroom cloud. "Dave," Steve shouted. "What about David? Is he alive?"
"I don't know," Ralph said. He looked at them with dazed and teary eyes. "I can't feel him breathing at all."
"Put him down," Cynthia said, "and lay him straight."
Cynthia closed her eyes and bent toward David. What she felt relieved her enormously.
a faint but clear touch of breath on her face.
"He's alive. I can feel him breathing. I'm going to help him now."
She used the fingers of her left hand to open his mouth, leaned forward, and gently pinched his nostrils shut with her right hand. Then she put her mouth on his and exhaled. His chest rose more steeply, then settled as she released his nose and pulled away from him. She breathed deep into his mouth again and said,
"Come back to us, David,"
as he exhaled a mixture of his air and hers. His unassisted breathing was a little stronger now, she thought, as she could see his eyeballs moving beneath his blue-tinged lids, but he showed no signs of waking up.
"Come back to us, David. Come back."
Johnny looked around, blinking like someone just back from the further reaches of his thoughts.
"Where's Mary? I guess we better go look for her."
He picked up the shotgun and the rifle. He handed the latter to Ralph.
"Stay here with your boy and the young lady," he said. "We'll be back."
Ralph watched Steve and Johnny through the door, then turned back to Cynthia and his son.
"What's wrong with David? Do you have any idea? Did that bitch choke him into a coma?"
"I don't think he's unconscious at all, let alone in a coma. Do you see the way his eyelids are moving? It's more like he's asleep and dreaming, or in a trance."
David breathed quietly through pursed lips. Behind his bruised eyelids, his eyes moved and moved. In the men's room, they found one dead cougar, its head mostly blown off, and one dead veterinarian with his eyes open. In the ladies' room, they found nothing, or so it seemed to Steve.
"Shine your light back over there," Johnny told him.
When Steve retrained the flashlight on the window, he said,
"No, not the window. The floor underneath it."
Steve dropped the beam and ran it along half a dozen beer bottles standing against the wall just to the right of the window.
"The doc's booby trap," Johnny said. "Not broken, but neatly set aside."
Steve turned to Johnny with an alarmed look.
"Oh, shit. And Trajan came while we were occupied with David. Came and..."
"Took her" was how he meant to finish, but he saw the boss shaking his head and stopped.
"That's not what this says."
Johnny took the flashlight and ran it along the row of bottles again.
"I think that if the cop had showed up back here, she would have come running to us, screaming bloody murder. So there could be more of them. More like Audrey. I don't think she would have put those beer bottles aside for any stranger."
"What are you thinking, boss?"
Johnny looked around to make sure they were still alone. His face, dominated by his swelled and leaning nose, looked both tired and intent.
"David's mom."
"What?"
"It could have been. Think about it. You'll see how pretty it is in a ghastly kind of way."
Steve did. He suddenly found himself hoping Mary Jackson was dead. That was awful, but in a case like this, dead might be better, mightn't it?
"What do we do now?"
he asked. "Get out of this town, by any means possible."
"All right. If Dave is still unconscious, we'll carry him."
"Let's do it."
They started back to the lobby. David Carver walked down Anderson Avenue past West Wentworth Middle School. Then he turned an Ohio corner and began walking down Bear Street. That was pretty funny, since Bear Street and the Bear Street Woods were nine big suburban blocks from the junior high. But that's the way things worked in dreams. David looked across the street and saw Reverend Martin. In one hand, he held a bottle of J.W. Dant whiskey. David could barely stand to look at him. His eyes were empty and dead. Reverend Martin toasted him with the bottle and then drank.
"Go get him," he said. "This is where we're going to find out if you know where Moses was when the lights went out."
David walked on. He thought of turning around, but then a queer but strangely persuasive idea came to him. If he did turn around, he would see the mummy tottering after him in a cloud of ancient wrappings and spices. He walked a little faster. Up ahead was the break in the bushes which marked the entrance to the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The entrance to the path was guarded by an ancient stone statue. It was a jackal with a cocked head, an open snarling mouth, and buggy cartoon eyes that were full of fury. The tongue in its mouth was not a tongue at all, but a human head, Kali Intrajan's head, smoky bear hat and all.
"Fear me and turn aside from this path,"
the cop in the mouth of the jackal said as David approached. There are other gods than yours. Kanta, Kantuk. You know I speak the truth.
Yes, but my god is strong, David said in a conversational voice.
He reached into the jackal's open mouth and seized its psychotic tongue. He heard Intrajan's scream and felt it, a scream that vibrated against his palm like a joy buzzer. A moment later, the jackal's entire head exploded in a soundless, shardless flash of light. What remained was a stone hulk that stopped short at the shoulders. He walked down the path, aware that he was glimpsing plants he had never seen anywhere in Ohio before. Spiny cactuses and drum cactuses, winter fat, squaw tea, Russian thistle, also known as tumbleweed. From the bushes at the side of the path stepped his mother. Her face was black and wrinkled, an ancient bag of dough.
Yes, your god is strong, she said. No argument there. But look what he's done to me.
She held her hands out to him, displaying her rotting palms.
God didn't do that, David said, and began to cry. The policeman did it.
But God let it happen, she countered,
and one of her eyeballs dropped out of her head.
Turn aside from him and embrace mine. Mine is at least honest about his cruelty.
But this whole conversation, not just the petitioning, but the haughty, threatening tone of it, was so foreign to David's memory of his mother that he began to walk forward again.
You're not my mother. My mother's with my sister in heaven, with God.
He stepped forward, seized the head, and squeezed it between his hand. There was another of those soundless flashes, and this time, not even the body was left. He was alone on the path again. Ahead was the oak tree, with the Viet Cong lookout in it. At the base of the tree was a piece of red and silver paper, a Three Muskies wrapper. David bent over, picked it up, and stuck it in his mouth, sucking the smears of sweet chocolate off the inside, with his eyes closed. David spat the wrapper out and climbed to the Viet Cong lookout with the sweet taste of chocolate in his mouth. He climbed into the sound of rock and roll music. Someone was sitting cross-legged on the platform and looking out at the Bear Street woods. His posture was so similar to Brian's that for a moment, David was sure it was his old friend, only grown to young adulthood. Slung over the young man's shoulder was a radio on a strap. The music was coming from a small exterior speaker. The sound was tinny, but still way cool. Hot drums, killer bass.
Let me in, baby. I don't know what you got, but you better take it easy. This place is hot, and I'm so glad we made it.
Bri, he asked, grabbing the bottom of the platform and pulling himself up. That you? The man turned. He was slim, dark-haired under a Yankees baseball cap, wearing jeans, a plain gray T-shirt, and big reflector shades. David could see his own face in them.
Brian's not here, David, the dark-haired man said pleasantly.
Brian can't be here.
Brian's alive, you see.
I don't get you.
But he was afraid he did. David began to shiver.
I'm dead too, then, aren't I?
Nope, wrong. Lose one turn.
The man turned up the volume on his radio.
Wait a minute, baby, let it happen to you,
and smiled.
Spencer Davis Group, he said. Steve Winwood on vocals. Cool.
Yes, David said, and meant it. He felt he could listen to the song all day. It made him think of the beach and cute girls in two-piece bathing suits. The man in the Yankees cap listened a moment longer, then turned the radio off. He took off his cap, wiped the back of his neck with it, put it back on, and looked at David seriously.
And this is the land of the dead, but you're an exception. You're special.
Very.
Who are you? Why are you here?
And do I know you?
I do, don't I?
To make sure you know why you're here, David, to begin with, at least. So tell me, why are you here?
David looked at him in consternation.
Come on, the man said impatiently. Those are easy questions. Why did God make anyone?
To love and serve him, David said slowly.
Okay, good. And what is God? What's your experience of the nature of God?
I don't want to say.
David looked down at his hands, then up at the grave, intent man, the strangely familiar man in the sunglasses. He hesitated, then dragged out what he was really afraid of.
I'm scared you're God.
The man uttered a short, rueful laugh. Time was, I thought you were right. What do you know of the nature of God, David? What is your experience? With the greatest reluctance, David said,
God is cruel.
He looked down at his hands again and counted slowly to 5. When he had reached it and still hadn't been fried by a lightning bolt, he looked up again. The man in the jeans and T-shirt was still grave and intent, but David saw no anger in him.
That's right. God is cruel. We slow down, the mummy always catches us in the end, and God is cruel.
Why is God cruel, David? For a moment, he didn't answer. And then something Reverend Martin said came to him. The TV in the corner had been broadcasting a soundless spring training baseball game that day.
God's cruelty is refining, he said.
And all cruelty is good? God is good and cruelty is good?
No, hardly any of it's good, David said.
For a single horrified second, he saw Pi dangling from the hook on the wall.
What is cruelty done for evil?
Malice. Who are you, sir?
Never mind. Who is the father of malice?
The devil? Or maybe those other gods my mother talked about?
Never mind Kanta and Kantok, at least for now. We have bigger fish to fry, so pay attention. What is faith?
That one was easy.
The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen.
And what is the opposite of faith?
That was tougher. A real hairball, in fact.
Disbelief? He ventured.
No, not disbelief, but unbelief. The first is natural, the second willful. And when one is in unbelief, David, what is that one's spiritual state?
He thought about it, then shook his head.
I don't know.
Yes, you do.
He thought about it and realized he did.
The spiritual state of unbelief is desperation.
Yes. Look down, David.
He did, and was shocked to see that the Viet Cong lookout was no longer in the tree. It now floated like a magic carpet made of boards above a vast, blighted countryside. He could see buildings here and there amid rows of gray and listless plants. One was the mining Quonset they'd seen on the way into town. Another was the municipal building. Another was Bud Sud's.
This is the poison field, the man in the reflector sunglasses said. There will be no sweetening this earth. It must be eradicated. The poisoned field is a perversity and an affront to God.
The buildings had slipped behind them. Now the Viet Cong lookout floated above a vast pit. From this perspective, it looked like a sore which is rotted through the skin of the earth and into its underlying flesh. The sides sloped inward and downward in neat zigzags like stairs. In a way, looking into this place was like looking into a pyramid turned inside out. On the near side, these neat setbacks had broken through near the bottom. Where they had been, there was now a long slope of stony rubble. Between the side of the landslide and the broad gravel road leading down from the rim of the pit, there was a black and gaping hole. At the base of the pit, just below the ragged hole, was a parking area filled with pickup trucks and tread-equipped vehicles that looked sort of like World War II tanks. Nearby stood a rusty Quonset hut with a stove stack sticking crooked out of the roof. Off to the left of the metal building was a squat concrete cube. The sign on this one read, Powder Magazine, Authorized Personnel Only. Up one slope, above the gaping hole, was a wide area pocked with other, much smaller holes. David thought there had to be 50 of them at least, probably more. From each poked a yellow-tipped stick.
Looks like the world's biggest gopher colony.
This is a blast face, and those are blast holes, his new acquaintance lectured. And the active mining is going on right here. When you're getting ready to shoot, you lower a stick of dynamite with a blasting cap on it to the bottom of each hole. That's the igniter. Then you pour in a couple of wheelbarrows worth of ANFO, stands for ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. Those assholes who blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City used ANFO.
The man in the Yankee cap pointed to the powder magazine.
Lots of ANFO in there. No dynamite. They used up the last on the day all this started to happen. But plenty of ANFO.
I don't understand why you're telling me this.
Never mind. Just listen. Do you see the blast holes?
Yes, they look like eyes.
That's right. Holes like eyes. They're sunk into the porphyry, which is crystalline. When the ANFO is detonated, it shatters the rock. The shattered stuff contains the ore. Get it?
Yes, I think so.
That material is trucked away to the leach pads. The distribution heads and emitters are laid over it, and the rotting process begins. Voila! There you have it. Leach ore mining at its very finest. But see what the last blast pattern uncovered, David? He pointed at the big hole, and David felt an unpleasant, debilitating coldness begin to creep through him.
What is it?
He whispered. But he supposed he knew. Rattlesnake number one, also known as the China Mine, or the China Shaft, or the China Drift. The last series of shots uncovered it. To say they were surprised would be an understatement, because nobody in the Nevada mining business really believed that old story. But it's been here, David, all along. And now,
is it haunted? David asked, shivering. It is, isn't it?
Oh, yes, the man in the Yankees cap said, turning his silvery no eyes on David. Yes, indeed.
Whatever you brought me up here for, I don't want to hear it, David cried. I want you to take me back to my dad. I hate this. I hate being in the land of...
He broke off as a horrible thought struck him. The land of the dead. That was what the man had said. He'd called David an exception, but that meant...
Reverend Martin, I saw him on my way to the woods. Is he...
The man looked briefly down at his old-fashioned radio, then looked back up again and nodded. 2 days after you left, David.
Was he drunk?
Toward the end, he was always drunk. Like Billingsley.
Was it suicide?
No, the man in the Yankees cap said, and put a kindly hand on the back of David's neck. It was warm, not the hand of a dead person, at least not conscious suicide. He and his wife went to the beach. They took a picnic. He went in the water too soon after lunch and swam out too far.
Take me back, David whispered. I'm tired of all this death.
The poison field is an affront to God. I know it's a bummer, David, but...
Then let God clean it up, David cried. It's not fair for him to come to me after he killed my mother and my sister.
He didn't.
He stood aside and let it happen.
That's not true either. David shut his eyes and clapped his hands to his ears. He didn't want to hear any more. Yet the man's voice came through anyway. It was relentless. God was as relentless as a bloodhound on a fresh scent. And God was cruel. Why are you on earth? The voice seemed to come from inside his head now.
I don't hear you! I don't hear you!
You were put on earth to love God.
No!
And serve him.
No! To hell with God! To hell with his love! To hell with his service!
God can't make you do anything you don't want to.
Stop it! I won't listen! I won't decide! Do you hear? Do you...
Shh! Listen. Not quite against his will, David listened. Part 4. The China Pit. God is Cruel. Johnny was ready to suggest that they just get going. Cynthia could hold the kid's head in her lap and cushion it from any bumps when David raised his hands and pressed the heels of his palms to his temples. He took a deeper breath. A moment later, his eyes opened and looked up at them. Johnny, Steve, Cynthia, his father... the ragtag remains of the Collian Trajan Survival Society. Hi, David, Johnny said. Great to have you back. You're in Steve's truck. David struggled to a sitting position, swallowed, winced.
She must have shook me like dice.
Well, that fits, Steve said. He was looking at David cautiously. You remember Audrey doing that?
No, David said, but I was told.
Johnny shot a glance at Ralph, who shrugged slightly. Don't ask me.
Is there any water? My throat's on fire. We got out of the theater in a hurry and didn't bring anything but the guns, Cynthia said. But there's this. She pointed to a case of Jolt Cola from which several bottles had already been taken. David took one and drank deeply, wincing as the carbonation bit into his throat, but not slowing down on that account.
"We're getting out," Johnny said. "We'll try north first. There's some trailers in the road, but Steve says he thinks we can get around them."
"No!"
Johnny raised his eyebrows.
"Pardon?"
"We have to go down into the pit."
David's voice sounded hoarse, as if he'd been crying.
"What are you talking about, David?" Steve asked.
"Your mother?
'Cause it'd probably be better for her, not to mention the rest of us, if we..."
"No, that's not why. Dad?"
The boy reached out and took his father's hand. It was an oddly adult gesture of comfort.
"Mom's dead."
Ralph bowed his head.
"Well, we don't know that for sure, David, and we mustn't give up hope, but I guess it's likely."
"I do know for sure. I'm not just guessing."
David's face was haggard in the light of the crisscrossing flashlight beams.
"She's dead, but not at rest. She can't be as long as Tok inhabits her body."
"Who's Tok, David?" Cynthia asked.
"Tok is a god," David said. "Or a demon. It doesn't matter. What does is that my mom should be put to rest."
"Son, what matters is that we have to get out of here," Johnny said.
He was still managing to keep his voice gentle, but now he could hear an undercurrent of impatience and fear in it.
"My mom's dead, but Mary's not," David said. "She's still alive. She's in the pit."
Cynthia gasped.
"How did you even know she was gone?"
David smiled wanly.
"Well, I don't see her, for one thing. The rest I know the same way I know it was Audrey who choked me. I was told."
"By who, David?" Ralph asked.
"I don't know," David said, but he looked oddly thoughtful. "I don't even know if it matters. What matters is that he told me stuff. True stuff. I know it was."
"Story hour's over, pal," Johnny said. He had absolutely no desire to listen to a bunch of crazy dream quest shit from this spooky little Jesus scout.
The Jesus scout slid out of his cell somehow, killed the coyote and Trajan set as a guard, and saved your miserable life, Terry spoke up inside his head. "Maybe you should listen to him, Johnny." And that, he thought, was why he had divorced Terry in the first place, in a fucking nutshell. She had been a divine lay, but she had never known when to shut up and listen to her intellectual betters.
"It wasn't really the cop who killed my mother and sister and Mary's husband," David said, and gave Johnny a look that reminded him eerily of Terry. "And whoever I talked to while I was unconscious, it was really God. Only God can't come to people as himself. He'd scare them to death and never get any business done at all. He comes as other stuff. Birds, pillars of fire, burning bushes, whirlwinds."
"This is totally insane," Johnny shouted. "We have to get gone, don't you see that? We're parked on goddamn Main Street, shut up in here without a single window to look out of. He could be anywhere, up front behind the fucking wheel for all we know."
"He's gone," David said in his quiet voice. "The trailers he put in the road are gone, too. Don't you get it? He wants us to leave."
"Besides, what about Mary?" Cynthia asked.
"He says she's alive."
Johnny turned toward her, turned on her.
"You may want to pack your suitcases and travel Transgod Airways with David, but I think I'll pass."
"We'll listen to him," Ralph said in a low voice. Johnny looked around at the others and was dismally astounded to see they were in agreement. Only he stood apart. And Steve had the keys to the truck in his pocket. Yet it was him the boy was mostly looking at. The eyes were not just looking, though. The eyes were pleading. In a much lower voice, Johnny said,
"And Trajan's gone. You're sure of that?"
"Yes," David said. "He wants what you want, for us to leave."
"And why did he bring us here in the first place?"
"He didn't."
"What?"
"God brought us," David said, "to stop him."
He glanced at the circle of faces around him once again, and once again he finished by looking directly into Johnny Maranville's.
"You're insane, my boy," Johnny said. "Ordinarily I like that in a person. This is going a little too far, even for me. I haven't survived this long in order to be shot or pecked to death by buzzards in the desert. As for God, as far as I'm concerned, he died in the DMZ back in 1969. Jimi Hendrix was playing Purple Haze on Armed Services Radio at the time." listen to the rest, okay? Would you do that much?
Why should I?
Because there's a story.
David drank more Jolt, grimacing as he swallowed.
A good one. Will you listen?
There was silence in the back of the truck. Steve was watching Johnny closely. If he showed any sign of moving toward the rider's back door and trying to run it up, Steve meant to grab him. He didn't want to. He'd spent a lot of years in the savagely hierarchical world of backstage rock, but he would if he had to. So it was a relief when Johnny shrugged, smiled, hunkered down next to the kid, and selected his own bottle of Jolt.
Okay, so story hours extended, just for tonight. I have to tell you, though, this is one I'd like to hear end with, and they lived happily ever after.
Wouldn't we all?
Cynthia said. The first thing Mary was aware of was a smell, sweetish, rank, nauseating.
Oh, Peter, damn it to hell, she thought groggily. It's the fucking freezer. Everything's spoiled.
Something scuttered across her face. It felt both light and hairy. Mary sat up, pawing her cheeks with both hands. An enormous bolt of pain went through her head. Bright dots flashed across her vision in sync with her suddenly elevated heart rate, and she had a similarly bright flash of recall, one even Johnny Maranville would have admired.
I bumped my bad arm, putting up another crate to stand on.
Hold on, you'll be inside in a jiffy. And then she had been grabbed by Ellen. No, by the thing. Tuck, that had been wearing Ellen. That thing had slugged her, and then boom, boom, out go the lights. And in a very literal sense, they were still out. She had to flutter her lids several times simply to assure herself that her eyes were open. Something that felt the size of a walnut dropped into her hair. She screamed, at first beating at it with the flat of her hand. That did no good, so she slid her fingers into her hair and got hold of whatever it was. It squirmed, then burst between her fingers. Thick fluid squirted into her palm. She raked the bristly, deflating body out of her hair and shook it off her palm. Her palm felt hot and itchy, as if she had reached into poison ivy. She rubbed it against her jeans. Now she had a sense, perhaps it was only her imagination, but she didn't think so, of stealthy movement all around her. A rustling sound from the left, a slithering from the right. There was a sudden low squalling from behind her, there and gone before she could scream. That last one wasn't anything alive, she told herself. I think it was a tumbleweed hitting metal and scraping along it. I think I'm in a little building somewhere. She put me in a little building for safekeeping, and the fridge is out, just like the lights, and the stuff inside has spoiled. As slowly as she could, she began inching forward, hands out. Her fingers touched something. She gasped and almost recoiled. But that was just nerves. The thing was hard, unliving. A straight edge at the height of her torso. A table? She thought so. She walked her fingers across it and forced herself to freeze when one of the scuttery things touched her. It crawled over the back of her hand and down to her wrist, almost surely a spider of some sort, and then was gone. She moved her hand again, resisting the clamor of her mind to pull back. Here was a plate. No, a bowl with something in it. Congealed soup? Her fingers fumbled beside it and felt a spoon. Yes, soup. Her hand struck something hard and cylindrical. It fell over with a rattle she recognized at once, or hoped she did. Batteries in the tube of a flashlight. Cold, smooth metal. Yes, a flashlight. She could feel the switch lying against the web of skin between her thumb and forefinger. Now let it work, God, please, okay? She pressed the switch. Light sprang out in a widening cone, and her yammering heartbeat stopped dead in her ears for a moment. Everything stopped dead. The table was long, covered with lab equipment and rock samples at one end, covered with a checked piece of tablecloth at the other. This end had been set as for dinner, with a soup bowl, a plate, silverware, and a water glass. A large black spider had fallen into the water glass and couldn't get out. It writhed and scratched fruitlessly. Other spiders preened and strutted on the table. Among them were rock scorpions,
stalking back and forth like parliamentarians, their stingers furled on their backs. Sitting at the end of the table was a large, bald man in a Diablo Mining Corporation T-shirt. He had been shot in the throat at close range. The stuff in the soup bowl, the stuff she had touched with her fingers, wasn't soup, but this man's clotted blood.